This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I know everybody's fixated in some sense on the personalities of the young men involved in the attack on the cafe.
Yeah.
But if we were to step back and to look at the question of political violence in Bangladesh, where would you start?
Well, first of all, you need to understand Bangladesh is a country that has always called itself secular, democratic. We have never called ourselves an Islamic Republic the way Pakistan does. But in spite of that, over the last couple of decades, there has been a steady increase in the amount of militant and extremist thinking, sympathies for kind of these global radicalist causes, to the extent that no matter how much the government keeps saying things are still under control, there's still freedom of speech, the fact is there isn't anymore. These ultra-religious elements have taken over.
What about the legitimate sort of desires of those in Bangladeshi society that would like to see Islam as a way of life be part of the way in which the country is governed, the shape or character of its politics? Is there and has there been a space given to that expression of Islam through politics in Bangladesh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know that recently Jamaat-e-Islami, the Islamist party, was banned by the ruling party, as well as, you know, kind of outfits that have always been friendly towards Jamaat, JMB, Jamaat-ul-Mujahideen Bangladesh. You know, they've been branded a terrorist organization, as they should be, as they are. And because these parties are now no longer allowed to do legitimate politics. You know, one of the things that was mentioned to me earlier yesterday was the fact that JMB, Jamaat, these parties have been so cornered lately, particularly with, you know, the war crimes trials that have happened. With not having enough of a voice, there is a backlash. Now, it would be irresponsible to say that the lack of political space is all that's responsible for the backlash, because it's a much bigger problem, for example, than the fact that Nizami was executed or Saka Chowdhury, Kamruzzam, and all these guys were executed. Sure, there's a lot of resentment from that, and there are a lot of people willing to be up in arms for that. You know, having said that, is that solely responsible for the attacks at Holy Artisan Bakery? These executions have been happening since 2013.
And these are for war crimes related to the Independence War in 1971.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these executions are 45 years in the making. I mean, you could say they're 45 years too late. Understandably, the international community is a bit perplexed. They're saying, why now? You know, these crimes happened in 1971. And let me be clear about one thing. There is no doubt that all these guys are guilty. They have been proven to have been complicit in rape, murder, genocide, kind of the destruction of entire villages, and the people who have been executed are the guiltiest of the guilty. There is no doubt about that.
But you're saying that this is not the only determinant in what's happening now. Again, just another kind of a point that's in kind of the news cycle. We read in June of mass arrests, and I think some numbers, ABC News had it at some 8,000 suspected Islamist militants were arrested. Now, what came of that action by the government?
Yeah, huge numbers of people were arrested. But my feeling is that drive, well-meaning as it was, ultimately it didn't do much good. I mean, what good did it do? The government can't really show anything. It seems to have been largely for show, as a kind of display, you know, look, militancy is on the rise, but look, we're doing something. Look, we arrested 8,000 people. That drive went on for days. But if you look into how many of those arrests were actually arrests of terrorists or killers of the recent, series of, we've had a series of killings of writers, bloggers, journalists. None of those arrests really pin someone to one of those crimes. And the fact is militancy has been gaining momentum, and these drives have not done enough about it. We've had other large undertakings recently by the government. For example, there was a there was an initiative for mandatory biometric SIM card registrations. So if you own a cell phone, which everyone does, you know, you have to register your SIM card with your fingerprint, and everyone has to do it, even if you've had that same SIM card for 15 years. A lot of people have said, you know, why do I have to do this? They said for security reasons. They've made it mandatory for tenants to fill out a form for the police station, you know, giving all kinds of details like your number, numbers of all your family members, really blatant invasions of privacy. All this in the name of security. The government says, we want to catch terrorists, please cooperate with us. And the people have been cooperating, and now the people are exhausted. They said, we've been cooperating, but so what? You know, crime is only increasing. We feel utterly unsafe. What have you guys done? The country feels less secure than ever.
Does the Bangladesh state actually have the strength and competence to control this problem?
That is a good question. I think they can certainly do more than they are actually doing. Part of the problem is there is a certain lack of will. There is a lot of appeasement of terrorists going on deliberately. I understand we don't have kind of the technology that you see in the West or maybe even in Malaysia, for example. But we also lack the political will. There has been a lot of appeasement of terrorists, for example. Every February we have a book fair, a national book fair. And, you know, just to give you one example, this year one bookstall was shut down because there were reports that there was one book in there which was controversial, offensive to Islam. And so, you know, without any trial, police just marched in, shut down that bookstall, and we never got to see what was in there. Me, even as a member of the press, it was very hard for me to even get my hands on the copy to judge whether or not there was something offensive in there. And no one from the government really answered for it. So that's what the government is doing. We're living in a culture where bookstalls are getting shut down, bloggers, journalists are getting killed, and the government is not even in terms of making a statement, not even in terms of assuring the public to say, we are doing enough. They're not. Let me just bring up one example of the LGBT editor who you've heard of, Zulhas Mannan, who was killed. He was the editor of a gay magazine in Bangladesh, and he was recently murdered. And the Home Minister's response to that was, well, people should not be writing or spreading these things. It's not part of our culture. Now, that is a statement of victim blaming if I ever saw one. So when our Home Minister says things like that, you can't tell me the government is doing all they can to stop this.
Well, in Malaysia recently, we had a grenade attack on a pub. First, the police said that it wasn't a terrorist attack, and then subsequently they said it was. What was interesting about that, when the subsequent arrest, was some two police officers were implicated in the attack. Is it possible that militant ideology or sympathizers exist within the Bangladeshi state, whether it's in the police force, in the military, in political parties even?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it seems more likely now than ever. You know, I just told you that Jamaat was not a legitimate political party anymore. So what do? These guys, their extremist sentiments, they don't disappear. So if they don't have that label, that party under which they can be in the national scene anymore, they're going to morph into other parties, you know, so they're going to be part of the Awami League or whatever they have to do to spread their influence. So, I mean, the names are changing, they're morphing, you know, they come under names like Jamaat, JMB, Hefazat, Hizbut Tahrir. They might these days come under names we don't even recognize, but ultimately it's Islamist, it's extremism, it's militancy. Now, so, yeah, it's everywhere.
Now, the incumbent government of Bangladesh comes from the party, the Awami League, doesn't it? As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, there are two major parties in Bangladesh. There's the Awami League, and then there's the party of the BNP, the Bangladesh yeah. National Party. Are these the two main players there now still? And what is party politics? Is party politics exacerbating problems with regard to this, or is it it's helping to solve the problem?
Well, you're asking if there are two major players. There used to be. I would argue there's only one real player now, and that's the Awami League. The BNP really has not existed as a real formidable party for quite some time. I mean, this happened, you know, in the elections at the end of 2013, actually in January of 2014, when BNP refused to participate in the national election for complicated reasons. You know, they wanted a caretaker government, and the AL said, no, we're going to oversee the election, no need for a caretaker government. So anyway, long story short, the BNP did not participate, and the AL kind of won the election unilaterally. And ever since then, the AL has just grown, and, you know, the BNP has shrunk in every way. And the Awami League has so much muscle now. The BNP party chief, Khaled Azia, was kept under house arrest for a long time. You know, so really, it's one party. It's the Awami League. The BNP exists in name only, right now.
And does it augur well for the fight against radicalism, or is it, you know, what does it mean for dealing with this particular problem?
Some people think it's a good thing. Some people think it's a good thing because the AL has always been known to be the more secular party. You know, it was. You know, our prime minister is the daughter of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, the founder of the nation. You know, the AL was built upon secular ideals. They always maintained Hindus, Christians, Buddhists. Everyone is equal and has rights in the country. So some people think the AL is really the only thing holding back the Islamists from taking over. And I don't know if that's true, but it's a scary idea because on the one hand, you have this one-party, you know, almost totalitarian state, if you will. On the other hand, you have the argument, are these guys all we have to stop Jamaat sympathizers, Islamic State sympathizers, from really taking over and turning this country into another, well, I don't know, Syria, whatever, you know.
Is Bangladesh on the brink of a civil war? And if so, who are the stakeholders and what would be the divide when it comes to that?
I think so. You know, recently, you know, personally, I have been feeling that, you know, a war was fought on our soil 45 years ago and this is war all over again. There is certainly that feeling of panic, of dread, the feeling that we're living in war times. The country is somewhat divided over all these things. For example, Zakir Naik at Peace TV recently got banned in Bangladesh. It just got banned, actually. And that is dividing people. So because Zakir Naik had a huge following in Bangladesh, as he does in Malaysia as well. You know, I once heard on your show. That's kind of one of those highly divisive issues where, you know, you have millions of followers, and on the other hand, kind of Zakir Naik being accused of having influenced the terrorists. You know, they had posted Facebook statuses. They had said they followed his words. So yeah, in a way, there's those splits in conversation. There's that overall dread, you know, when you go out, when you meet people, there's that feeling, you know, what's going to happen? Who are the people around me? Are they on my side? Are they on the other side? I don't know if civil war is the right word for it, but it feels like some kind of war, definitely a war of ideas.
Many people attribute the rise of militancy or radicalism to the disaffected, the marginal, the people who have been oppressed by, you know, Western imperialism in many countries under extreme pressure because of, you know, military action and such. But we come back to the case of this cafe attack and some of the young men involved in it. You know, the shock of the fact that they come from privileged backgrounds, affluent, perhaps with a cosmopolitan education and potentially at some point a cosmopolitan outlook. What has been the thinking about these particular individuals? Are they just kind of anomaly or do they signal something deeper about what's going on?
I think they signal something deeper. You know, there has been a lot of shock at the revelation that these kids, well, they are kids, they're very young, that they went to Scholastica, which is, you know, one of the most prestigious schools in Bangladesh. They went to North South University, again, you know, another expensive university. You know, so far the thinking had been it's all kind of madrasa-educated orphans who get radicalized. Now we're seeing that everyone is susceptible. So,
but what are they attracted to? I mean, is it the kind of machismo of the radical, you know, holding his gun, you know, and sort of dying in a shootout, the beautiful death? What is attracting these young rich men?
I think Bangladeshis, a lot of young Bangladeshis, are simply very disenchanted with the way things are going. You know, there is, many of them have had an absolutely non-religious upbringing, and some of them have had a quasi-religious upbringing. And interestingly, even the ones who never had religion before, many of them have fallen into crisis situations, felt absolutely broken, and that's when they got scooped up by these kind of terrorist networks who came to them and said, you know, hey, we can make your life better. Look what being an atheist has done to you. You know, come to the path of God. You know, so there have been stories. I mean, I've heard reports of kids who were just scooped up like that and then kind of brainwashed, shown videos, taken away. And so a lot of these students, they dropped off the radar. Their parents didn't know where they were. Nobody knew where they were. So they were probably holed up in some jihadi room or basement, kind of being fed these ideas, being brainwashed. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, whatever void was there, whatever broken promises they felt about Bangladesh, about Western lifestyle, about resenting how Bangladesh has failed to give them the things they were promised, you know, a lot of this resentment was preyed on. And recently the Home Minister gave out a directive to universities and said, give us a list of students who have been absent for 10 days or more. And noble as that intention is, I think it's kind of solving the wrong problem. You know, people are, you know, just because students haven't been showing up to school, and there's a big country, I'm sure that list will be massive. I don't know how you can sift through that list to find who's a terrorist and who isn't. You know, nobody likes going to school, but yeah, you know, it's a problem.
You know, for us who don't understand, again, who don't understand Bangladesh and the nuances of the arguments and the intricacies of its politics, what would you signal to us to keep in mind when following the story that's unfolding in Bangladesh today? I mean, what were the key points that you would have us note?
I would say keep in mind that this has been brewing for a long time. I would say follow definitely the stories of the killings of writers, editors, bloggers. This signals very clearly that Bangladesh is closing up space for free and democratic discourse. As a member of the press, I understand that very clearly. My colleagues, myself, we always have to keep that in mind when we're writing. You have to keep an eye on the fact that militancy is spreading into places where it didn't exist before. The thing about Bangladesh as a society is to keep in mind that, you know, we're a highly stratified kind of class-based society. There is an elite upper class and kind of the madrasa classes, the kids who go to madrasas because that's where they are socioeconomically, and we've always thought they were the ones who would always be radicalized. There is a lot of class resentment. I mean, I will just come out and say that. You know, the recent attacks at Holy Artisan Bakery that happened, the thing to understand about Holy Artisan is that it was a very elite, expensive place in the most expensive part of Dhaka. So now that this happened, a lot of people are saying, oh, so rich people finally got it. You know, it's a terrible thing to say, but that's what, you know, a lot of people are feeling, and a lot of people are saying, oh, hey, you know, poor people have been dying all the time. Now rich people have been attacked. So that is one extra thing that I would put out there. Amidst this war against radicalism, against extremism, there's also tremendous class tension brewing, where, you know, not everyone feels the same way about this terrible attack that we saw on July 1st.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.